So I'm recording now. You have a beautiful view behind you.
Yeah, I thought that might distract from whatever nonsense we might talk about, but
I've heard New Zealand is absolutely gorgeous.
is. It's one of the most stunning places I've ever been. It's pretty wild.
Put that on my list.
Yeah,
Sorry,
so but
are you on vacation?
yeah, we're doing a little vacation, traveling, just camping through, kind of doing a loop through the South Island. I'm with my wife and we're just camping out mostly, but we stopped for an Airbnb
Okay.
and they have quite the view.
Oh, they sure do. That's
Or in Queenstown, so that's kind of like pretty far south by some lakes.
Okay. Yeah, that looks absolutely gorgeous. That looks like one nice place to, well, looks like one nice place to be. You and a whole bunch of sheep.
There are a bunch of sheep.
You sent me a you sent me an interesting link about toxic masculinity. Is that what you're kind of thinking about wanting to talk about?
Well,
Or
it
do you have something else on
was
your
that.
mind?
Well, I've got plenty of things on my mind, so I kind of was just I've been off the grid for like a week, so no internet access. And so yesterday I kind of, as we got into town, just tried to catch up on some things. And well, when I originally had contacted you about talking about toxic masculinity, it was, really on my mind quite a bit because of how much controversy was surrounding it at the moment. But these things have a way of just kind of fading into the background quite quickly, which is good.
Well, and if you're camping around New Zealand, the last thing you should be doing is paying attention to what's going on Twitter or,
Oh yeah. I was very thankful for the break away from the internet and from all of that, but it seems to occupy my mind quite a bit whenever I have access to it.
It can all get so self-important, and you take a step back and you realize, there's important stuff going on, but so much of it is it's vanity, it's clouds, and they blow away.
Vanity. Yeah, it is, and it does. And it's just reactionary, I suppose. But it did make me think quite a bit, which I do appreciate. And it makes me really question things and question the validity of some of the issues that are brought to the forefront. And well, I for whatever reason was imagining the story of King David as being sort of this archetypal toxic masculinity. And the whole story was just kind of like banging around in my mind.
Well, David is such an interesting character on that topic because, on one hand, he's this uber warrior. On the other hand, he's so emotionally available that he writes all these psalms, and then he dances, at the bringing the ark in. He dances with so much enthusiasm that his wife tells him to cut it out. She probably wanted to have him to have a little bit more toxic masculinity at that point. Don't be raising your skirts in front of those slave girls and giving them a peek at the crown jewels. So, David is this figure in the Bible that really in the Old Testament, there are a few that rank that high. You've really got Moses and David in some ways are two of the pillars of the Old Testament. Elijah too, and it's often Moses and Elijah is kind of the law and the prophets, and they show up on the Mount of Transfiguration. But David, Jesus inhabits, in many ways, Jesus occupies David's throne. That's how he stands.
And yes, he's the lineage of David.
Yeah,
explicitly.
Yes,
and for that purpose of it, it's interesting to me that you know he David is kind of the embodiment of the toxic masculinity, but also you know the counterposition of that as well. So you know it hides none of these things, the story of in the Bible. So that's why I was you know going back to this story is just almost like it's like a Harlequin novel at some point. Just reads like it, which I love. You know, it like really speaks to the humanity of it all.
Yeah. Well, and he's so one of the things I love about the Bible is David is just such a fully realized and rounded character. He's both an example and an outrageous sinner. And the Bible in the story manages to put all that forward without denying any of it. And that's to me sort of like Peterson's idea that ideologies are crippled religions. You know, black hat and white hat, or good guy and bad guy, comparisons are kind of like ideologies compared to a full-fledged biblical character like David, who on one hand is a man after God's own heart, and he's also someone who is called to account for what he does to Bathsheba. And Nathan comes and tells him this story, and David stands up in righteous indignation. That man deserves to die. And Nathan shoots back at him, "You are that man." I mean, these stories are just, you know, they're just, I don't know why I don't know why Hollywood always messes up the telling of these stories. A number of years ago, there was an NBC series called Kings that had the story of David and Saul. And what was the actor's name for Saul? He had played in Deadwood. He's just an amazing actor, and he was a perfect Saul. and the young guy was a really good David, and the show was developing really well. And the fact that you know, you knew it was David and Saul, but they reset the setting and they're pulling out the nuances. And then they canceled the show. I thought, the one time I see them actually doing a credible job in television, or most Bible movies are horrible. Mm-hmm. And here's an example where they're really doing a good job in it, and they pull the plug. So.
Oh, I know. That's always that way.
Yeah.
Unfortunate.
Yeah. David's a wonderful, wonderful example to bring into to toxic masculinity, because it's all there.
Yeah, yeah. It hides nothing.
No.
But I didn't develop that idea much more than just thinking about it. And, I was kind of driven to read into and read more about where the phrase came from, toxic masculinity, which is kind of a depressing rabbit hole to go down. But there's a lot of postmodern feminist literature, I guess, written by a person. I think her name is Rywin Connell. And she's the one that originally coined the phrase. And she's from Australia. I think I can't remember where she's from, or she's an author and a professor, but some of her literature is actually written into the APA guidelines.
Really?
And she's a transgender woman, and so from Australia. Huh. And so some of her writings are very interesting, and I mean, she's often sort of characterized as just having a Marxist presupposition and then building sort of all of her philosophies off of that presupposition. And it's hard to read because it's just sort of a cheeky sort of critique of just the toxic masculine, and just all the negative aspects of the masculine. And her ideas are trying to like build on all of the ideas of that masculinity isn't just one thing, but it's a multitude of things, and there's all different types of masculinities. That's the title of her book, is Masculinities. So it's difficult to read, you know, with all of my presuppositions of like masculinity being this sort of David archetype, and I'm not really bringing all of these other types of masculinities to the table. So she's, you know, I don't really know how to understand it, but it's interesting how the culture sort of just grasps onto this phrase, that they're completely unaware of where it came from. And that's what really got me sort of, it just kind of blew me away whenever I saw people from within the church on Facebook and social medias just like say, this is a valid concept and we need to consider this.
Yeah.
And they don't really realize what it is that they're talking about, I guess. I mean, it's, yes, toxic masculinity is a thing. It's always been a thing, but that phrase is not just a neutral phrase, I guess.
Well, the weaponized word in that phrase and that meme is really toxic. And if you take some time deconstructing using the word toxic, and now, you know, lately, because the funny thing about memes are that when they do gain power, they start then to mutate. And so toxic now gets mutated. You know, it's just like Watergate and Gamergate, and you know, that you always have gate gets tacked onto any scandal. So, you know, the weaponized meme just goes and goes, and toxic, same thing has happened with toxic.
Okay.
But if you would stop and think about, okay, well, what do we mean toxic? Well, we use toxic because, well, that's obviously a metaphor on poison. And we want to imagine that, okay, this particular type of masculinity, as if, you know, and then you get down to the question of, okay, well, how can we represent these things? And so then, of course, part of what Peterson was so helpful with all this stuff is just fleshing out some of this language where you act it out. And so then Gillette and their commercial acts it out. And it was funny because while that whole thing was going on, I was talking with my wife because she teaches in a school, and we were talking about how sometimes people, as a pastor, sometimes something will happen in someone's life and they got to talk to me right away. And in some cases, that is exactly the wrong time to talk to them because she was talking about a principal that she used to have in one of her previous schools. He was a very wise guy, Dr. Ma. And Dr. Ma would always say, when you see two kids fighting on the playground, walk towards them slowly. And that's very similar to, you know, Peterson's story about him and the scrape he's going to get in with one of his friends on the ball field over a girl and his mother walking and just keeping walking. And that gets into a bunch of the Jonathan Haidt stuff, that kids need unsupervised play and they have to work things out. So then in the Gillette commercial, you have these two kids that are starting to scrap and the father rushes in right away. And it's like,
Was the image that stuck with me too.
Yep. And then it's like, no, actually the healthier masculinity, let's set aside the religious stuff. Let's just look at the science according to someone like Jonathan Haidt. The actual masculinity and the contribution of the masculine into that dynamic, the contribution of the feminine is rush in and break them up right away. The contribution right. of the masculine is pause.
Pause,
let,
yeah.
Let the kids work some stuff out. You know, yep. Now, if some of them pulls a knife, yeah, you jump in. But a five-year-old usually isn't going to pull a knife. This is...
A well-armed five-year-old.
That's a well-armed five-year-old. But the point of this is, let these kids work on this stuff when they're 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, when they're not really strong enough to really hurt somebody else, so right. that when they become 16, 18, 20, you know, they do, you know, that's, what was the guy, Warren Farrell, that Peterson and also Rebel Wisdom had him on. You know, Warren Farrell was a wonderfully wise and so much good advice in talking about, you know, let kids work this out, because that's the kind of learning they need to do that scales through life. But in our contemporary desire to forget any kind of conventional wisdom or what we might have learned from the past, we just have right. to right. scandalize it, weaponize it, and banish it to the okay. to the harm of our children. So,
uh-huh. Yeah. So this kind of is a good transition into some of the other things I wanted to talk about. Like, I've always sort of, I've talked to you before about how I still consider myself a Christian, but not in the fundamentalist sense, I suppose, of rejecting evolution. I've always sort of been attempting to unify those things of like the Piagetian unification of religion and science. The first public speech I ever had to give in college was about whether or not evolution and the biblical account and of Genesis were mutually exclusive, and that. For me, I've never seen those two things as clashing so much as just being two different perspectives entirely, and taking a lot of work to attempt to unify them, obviously, considering how broad both of those things are. But the more that I study them, both of the scriptures and science, evolution, they seem to want to help one another. It's for me, I guess. and you know, it's right now, it seems like both wings of the political spectrum are highly skeptical of the evolutionary biology.
That's ironic.
You know, at first it was just the right wing that was right. denying the evolution, and now it's the left wing, and
right.
center is the thing that's trying to unify religion and science, which is, you know, it's very strange. And I'm still open to all kinds of skepticism about evolution. You know, that has plenty of flaws, the theory, but just the basic Darwinian understanding of adaptation, and as we look as deep into the past as we can, we see we have a greater vision into it, I think. But I'm not sure where I was going with that.
It's a difficult subject, and you know, Esther O'Reilly, if you know, we post this and she sees it, which she usually does, she's going to have about 20 tweets for me. And but you know, evolution, the word is about, you know, one word is about as low resolution as possible, and the better we up the resolution on that word, the better conversation we can have, which in my tradition is of the two books being Special Revelation of the Bible, General Revelation, you know, everything that we get from out here in science and empiricism and rationality, so on and so forth. So, you know, it's one of the things that, you know, the Metaphysical Club, which is one of these books that Peterson has on his list, one of the great points in that book that Menard makes is that what Darwin adds to the evolution conversation is the, and it's really interesting, is the assertion that this happens without purpose.
Right. So evolution in that very narrow vision is right. Obviously been completely, you know, it's obviously way more than that.
Right. And that's usually where, and it's interesting because if you look at that, you can then ask the question, okay, why at that moment did it take that turn when prior to that, and afterwards, there are plenty of Christians that basically said God used processes to create the world.
Okay.
In fact, there's nothing that in Genesis 1, there's a process of creation where it's, you know, it's God speaking, and then it's let the earth bring forth animals and let the seas bring forth. I mean, there's even in the Genesis 1 account, there's process. So,
right.
But I think your observation that it's very interesting because if you had asked someone 15 years ago, most of the, especially the new atheists, were continuing the early 20th century optimism in their camp that science is going to run the field. And it's only these recalcitrant Christian fundamentalists who are going to court in Kansas and other places in the Bible Belt that are trying to fight, you know, evolution and science in public school. And so once we clear out these Christians, then we will inherit the land. And the irony is that, well, you know, they haven't managed to clear out the Christians, but now they look over their left shoulder and all of the people that they thought were safe are now saying, well, boy, girl, this is just assigned at birth by bigoted obstetricians that when they see a penis, they say, boy. And it's like, that's why, you know, a lot of the new atheists, some of them are freaking out because they were, you know, trying to battle to their right, figuring that everything to the left of them was safe. And now they turn to the left and discover all these people are abdicating. So now they got fights on the right and the left. And yeah, so that's why a lot of them are now looking to, you know, other Christians who have not been quite so allergic to the word evolution and saying, well, maybe we could talk to these guys because, we weren't ready to fight a battle to our left. And why so many simplistic predictions of progress, they don't even last 10 or 20 years. And if you're old enough to have lived through a few decades, you begin to watch this and say, yeah, you think this is the way things are going to go? Good luck. Wait a decade or two. And, you know, the kinds of things you never thought you'd see, you might see them.
Yeah. Well, this makes me think about, you know, what is a miracle exactly? And what is, you know, you say there's two books, the general revelation and the natural revelation.
Special revelation, we call it divine revelation.
Right. So this sort of general or natural revelation is what seems to go quite hand in hand with evolution, generally speaking, because it helps to give us an understanding of this progression. Just in the natural sense, it helps us make sense of the world. And it's done that to a degree that, you know, you can parse it out and say, this is evolution and this is not, but, you know, it has been a tool in the progression of science and medicine that we still use and we exist upon.
Yep.
And so we can't exactly deny all of it. You know, right. You can say there's genetics and then there's evolution, but we definitely use these medicines and technologies, you know, and so you could say that evolution is just a technology or a revealing of something, an understanding. And, well, you know, C.S. Lewis wrote the book Miracles, and he was, the more I'm listening to your videos, he was a denier, he was very skeptical of evolution, and
Not really. He wasn't skeptical of evolution. He was skeptical of evolutionism.
Okay. Well, I just remember you saying that he wrote in a letter or a book that evolution was sort of the foothold of something evil. I thought that was what I heard you say, but I could just be misremembering. And, you know,
he wasn't a scientist, and so he didn't really take on those debates so much. But, mm-hmm. you know, similar to someone, let's say, like Alvin Plantinga, Plantinga has actually been more aggressive in that. Plantinga's more pushed things like intelligent design, which, again, mm-hmm. once you say that word, there's a low resolution word that'll cause a lot of commotion. But Lewis didn't really have skepticism that there were processes that brought about the world as we know it today. It's some of the philosophical assumptions beneath Darwin's assertion that, well, this happens without agency guidance. So after I get off with you, I'm going to make a video, probably a fairly long one, where I get into some of these issues because part of what the question that I keep running into is, okay, where's the line here? And I've been reading Michael Pollan's book on psychedelics. And one of the things I'm going to point out in that video is a number of places he's really wrestling with. He wants to keep the idea of spiritual, and he wants to keep the idea that these psychedelic drugs are in some ways revelatory in some significant sense, psychologically, interpersonally, and then spiritually. But he keeps having, I don't mean supernatural. It's that word right there, supernatural, which is mm-hmm. itself a very modern conception that. Mm-hmm. That's where there's a line, and people, for sake of pride, say that line I won't cross.
Right.
And Lewis would, along with many who believed in the older term was theistic evolution, that God works through processes, and that's, I think, a very biblical idea because the Bible, being very much a history book, would say that God works through historical processes to achieve goals he wishes to achieve, including David, Jesus, Moses, and mm-hmm. and that's why within my theological tradition we have this idea of organic inspiration, that God moves through history. And so the idea that he would move through a biological process, even a very long biological process, isn't in any way out of bounds to my conception of the way God works in the world.
Yeah. Well, maybe it's this split world problem that you often bring up, that we're attempting so desperately to unify the general revelation and the special revelation, and they just won't have it. I don't know. Well, they're just two separate things for a reason.
There's always tension between heaven and earth, and that's basically how the Bible sets it up. But what's interesting to me are the psychological motivations to resist the idea that there are other agentful consciousnesses at mm-hmm. work in the world around us.
Mm-hmm.
Because God is obviously the big conscious agent in the story, but there are angels and demons. And right. It's funny because someone Gravity. Who is really allergic to the idea of the supernatural or God has no problem talking about, well, what if aliens come? Well, aliens are another class of potentially powerful conscious agents outside of human beings. Mm-hmm. And then, well, what do we do with aliens? Well, we put them in movies and they're usually either bad guys or saviors. And I think, well, that's really telling our, mm-hmm. our post-Christian biases are showing in all of this, in that we've basically got unresolved issues with respect to conscious agents that have their way with us against our wills. So mm-hmm. that's really where, in my opinion, I see people drawing the line and saying, I love the idea of a conscious agent as long as I know they'll be good. And mm-hmm. once you look at the God of the Bible, mm-hmm. Christians say, yeah, he's good, but he's not a name.
Yeah, you have to say he's good because you don't believe it. I don't know.
or exile him.
Right. I don't know if you've ever encountered the phenomenon in churches where people will say chant the phrase, God is good all the time God is good. That's always just bugged the hell out of me that people do that. Because I'm like, why that? Where did that even come from? You know? And it's obviously because you don't believe it that you have to say it. It's not because you believe it so deeply.
That's right.
So
and the Bible puts us, again, just like the story of David, the Bible puts us in this territory where the Bible is easier. It's easier for characters in the Bible to admit that God is strong.
Right, right. Don't know what good is.
Right, his goodness. And so that's, especially in the Old Testament, that's a subject of serious theological debate ongoing. You get to the New Testament revelation of Jesus, and that's where you really get this very out loud declaration of the goodness of God, but whether or not we're going to like what this goodness looks like continues to cause us anxiety.
Anxiety, yeah, plenty of that.
Yeah, well, okay, so he's judging. Well, I don't know if I like that. Well, why don't you know if you like that? Because what if he judges the way I don't think he should? Okay, mm-hmm. Well, yeah, of course. That's what we always have with other conscious agents who have power.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we put ourselves in the place of this judge, and then what happens?
That's right. And now we're back to the beginning of the story, where part of the Adam and Eve story is we looked at God and said, yeah, but we'd really rather be in charge. And then Adam and Eve look at each other and say, well, as long as you defer to me. In other words, it's all about Tolkien's ring. I want to be in charge. It's my world and welcome to it, to rephrase an old thing from the television 60s.
Okay, there's your Tolkien reference.
That's right. Obligatory Tolkien reference.
Yeah. Well, I am in Hobbiton.
That's
oh, there's
right.
A beautiful, beautiful rainbow. Can you see it?
Wow. Oh, man. Oh, yeah, I see it. Yep. Oh,
there it is.
Oh my goodness.
Wow, that's
wow.
Cool.
Yeah, I'll tell you, I'm going to Australia and I'm looking
forward.
That's
right.
To
it. I was going to ask you about that.
Yeah, so there'll be a conference on March 30 in Melbourne, and I'll continue as once the official flyer is done, I'll post that on my channel, and I'll be preaching a couple times the Sunday after in some other churches.
Is it through your congregation or what?
No, it's a group of people in Australia that reached out to me and invited me to come.
Oh, cool.
And so I should really be promoting it like crazy, because the tickets at the door pay for my trip. But yeah. I've never been to Australia, but I'm going to spend a week of vacation ahead of time there, just because I don't want to have crazy jet lag. And yeah, if I'm going to fly to Australia, I want to see some stuff, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. So, it's in Melbourne, right?
Yeah. Yeah. It's in Melbourne. So, cool. But my wife's like, is New Zealand near there? Can we stop there? I'm like, honey, it's only so, she's the one that has to take time off work. I got to take vacation time too. But so it's like, well, maybe we'll do Australia another trip. But you start looking at pictures of Australia, and it's like, wow, there's so much to see. And it's like people coming to California. Oh, I'm going to see California. What, in a day? Good luck. California is a big place.
Right. Hey, California is near Texas. Maybe we could stop by.
That's right.
I'm not sure if you have much time left. I've got maybe 10 more minutes.
Yeah, go for it.
Okay. Well, I could talk about, I've got so many things I could talk to you about. I was going to chat with you about a correspondence that I had with Peterson, actually, in the email, which was just like a couple of emails, and before he got, you know, completely enormous and incontactable. But
he got mobbed by the zombie crowd, of which we are a part.
Yeah.
Brain.
Yeah. Wow. So I just sent him I was listening to Northrop Frye's lectures.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if you ever got through all of those.
I didn't. I should, though. They're Frye, he's so dry and slow as he goes.
I love it, though. It's so perfect.
It is. It's fun.
Yeah. Well, there was a part in one of his lectures. It's lecture 18 on the U of T webpage. Where he's talking about a verse in the Bible, Proverbs 8:30, and the King James reads like this: "Then I was constantly at his side. I was filled with delight day after day, rejoicing always in his presence, rejoicing in his whole world, and delighting in mankind." What Frye says about this scripture, he's talking about the language. You know, this is the Bible and English Literature is the name of this course. And this King James version is actually inadequate to use the word rejoice, you know, or we just don't quite understand that word the same. And the word in the Latin, the Vulgate, is ludens. L-U-D-E-N-S. And it translates to play. And this is the notion of wisdom as playing before God at the creation. And I don't know if you've, you know, read into, I mean, obviously, you know about Peterson's work with Jack Panksepp and the discovery of the play circuitry.
The little rats.
The little rats. tickling of rats.
Eraser. Pencil erasers.
Yeah. And so Huizinga, I guess I'm saying
Huizinga.
That right? Huizinga.
Huizinga.
Another fellow Dutchman of yours.
Yep.
Also
Homo Ludens.
Homo Ludens, right.
Yeah.
He wrote about this before it was even, you know, discovered scientifically, just more of a aesthetic sort of research.
Yep.
But all of this, you know, I just, you know, kind of sent in an email to Peterson saying, you know, I thought this would be useful, you know, these notions of this Bible verses, wisdom being in the presence of the Father, this safe space that we are able to play in. And that is like analog to development, you know. So you know, he responded, I think he said something like, Ludens is definitely, definitely better. Thanks.
So, and that's, well, okay. So you got Peterson's Order Chaos. Mm-hmm. If we look out the windows behind you, you know, there is about the most amazing, why are we thrilled when we look at that? Because we're like, that's a playground. That is the most outrageously amazing playground. Is it a safe playground? Well, hardly. You can drown, you can fall, you can freeze, but it's a playground and it's a glorious playground. So it's not, it's safe in the right way. And that's something that when I think about the age to come and, you know, the new heavens and the new earth, I don't quite know what God will do with that, because at least with everything we know, there needs to be enough chaos, enough risk to mm-hmm. bring some Verveke stuff in,
right,
to get into the flow state, to be fully realized. Mm-hmm. And now I often think about the fact that if, you know, people travel from all over the world to go see the Grand Canyon, because you get over, you get at the rim of the Grand Canyon, you look out, and especially if you can get there before sunrise, and then the sun comes up over the canyon and it just reveals itself to you, and it just, it's glory and it makes us gasp. And this is all people who have eaten breakfast and slept and haven't been running from bears or enemies. But if you were, I was over at Bryce Canyon last summer, and, you know, Bryce Canyon has all these hoodads, all this stuff all over the place, and it's one huge maze. And, you know, when back in the day when the Mormons were settling there and there were ranchers, and basically, you know, tourists would come and be like, oh, look at this, this is amazing. And the rancher's like, yeah, but it's a hell of a place to find your cow, you know.
Right.
So, you know, it's playground to those of us, you know, I've got a full belly, my body feels good. Oh, playground. But to a rancher trying to survive and, you know, find his cow, it's like, oh, he went into the canyon. What am I going to do? I'll never find that stupid cow.
On the very surface, it's a very beautiful, and underneath the tip of the iceberg is terror.
Yes.
A very terrifying thing that sort of upholds this beauty.
Yeah. And makes the beauty. And that's, you see, and when it gets to, I mean, this is part of what C.S. Lewis the point he tries to make when he says Aslan isn't a tame lion. Part of the beauty of Aslan is, okay, I trust him, but I know that with the swipe of his paw, I'm dead. And this goes into the fact, you know, you've got these people that do things, crazy things, like try to keep lions and tigers as personal pets. You know, it's that fascination that they think, wow, wouldn't it be cool to have a lion as a pet? Yeah. But the only way that works is if you make it less of a lion.
Right.
And so then you find the sad stories of chain link cages and, you know, animals with disease, and it's ugly.
Right. Because, and that, you know, sort of breaks down our categories of what is a lion exactly.
Yes. So instead we have these house cats. So my daughter last summer, there was a stray cat, a kitten, tiny little kitten my daughter brought in. And so we've been, you know, she went back off to college. It's like my daughter adopts cats and I get to take care of it. And she's graduating from college. She'll be back. Then it's her cat. But, you know, I always joke with my kids that if this cat had 200 more pounds, you know, we'd be prey. It's only because the cat is 10 pounds that, you know, cat gets ornery, gives, you know, tries to bite us, and we just smile.
Just laugh, yeah.
Yeah, I'll pick it up and throw it off the table because, you know, they always land on their feet. Amazing creature, but the only way it works is because the cat's only 10 pounds.
Right, they are entertaining.
Yeah. But if that cat was 50 pounds or even 75 pounds, oh, it'd be a whole different story.
Yeah. A bite would not be something to laugh about.
That's my son has a couple of cats, and he'll take pictures of sometimes the cat is up on a bookshelf looking down at him. I'd say, yeah, you know, if that cat had 75 more pounds, it'd be a whole different scenario.
Because I'm sure you heard about the guy that fought the puma off.
Yeah. Wow, or the granny that fought the mountain lion. There's a story, yeah. Or a bobcat. Granny scrapped with a bobcat. Oh, people can be pretty vicious.
Oh yeah, when it comes to survival, yeah.
Yeah. No, that's interesting, and I'm not surprised by Peterson's response. It's very Petersonian.
Yeah. Yeah, I thought that was funny. Oh. Oh well, I probably should let you go so we can get on the road.
All right.
About to travel a little bit further before we fly back home. So.
Well, thanks for interrupting your vacation, and I think this was a good conversation. Do I have permission to post it?
Yeah, please do.
Good. No, I thought this was a fun conversation, and thanks for the sharing that beautiful New Zealand scenery.
Yeah. Yeah.
And enjoy the rest of your trip, and thank your wife for giving me a little bit of your precious vacation time.
Okay, I'll do that.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Josh. Take care.
Right, bye.
Bye-bye.